State Attorney Melissa Nelson says she's keeping tabs on wayward police officers. Prominent names jump into local congressional races, and more problems for the Regency Mall as scores of people line up for jobs with e-tailer Amazon. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We're always live at 9 and never miss a show. Download the WJCT app. Listen to us there anytime. We've got a podcast on iTunes, too, or you can stream us live right now on Facebook. Just ahead, a look at the biggest stories of the week with our Friday roundtable. Get on the line now, 549-2937. Then later, we'll tell you all about the new faith-based project designed to improve community health on the First Coast. Plus, singing the praises of the local nonprofit, Rethreaded, a look ahead to one special concert, all of that ahead. But first, it's Friday and time for our weekly roundtable as we welcome A.G. Gankarski of Florida Politics.
Good morning.
Good to see you. WJCT's own reporter, Ryan Bank.
Good morning.
And making a return to the roundtable after quite some time away, our own producer, Kevin Merschart.
Good morning.
Good to have you. But our top story, it's a policy shift at the state attorney's office getting some attention. State Attorney Melissa Nelson says she's dropped dozens of criminal cases that relied on the testimony of recently arrested local police officers. Nelson is now keeping tabs on officers who've had questionable backgrounds. This is a switch from the policy of former state attorney Angela Corey, who did not keep what's known as a Brady list. We want to know what you think about the new approach at the state attorney's office. Give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. Weigh in as well on Facebook. A.G. Gankarski, let's begin with you. State Attorney Nelson campaigned on this type of change, a different approach to the way the prosecutor's office will be run, not only in the way criminal cases are handled, juvenile cases are handled, but also the relationship with local police. Nelson, we'll be getting probably some blowback from the police union over some of these changes, but what are your thoughts about this on the face of it?
I mean, it's consistent with her agenda that, like you said, that she elaborated during the campaign. This is not something she actually brought up during the campaign. And that was one, of course, where the police union was one of the few people really squarely behind Angela Corey. This is the kind of thing that is necessary in our market. We saw 8 years of Angela Corey where there was a perception that police and the state attorney's office were symbiotic, that there was no accountability. And, you know, this measure is actually something that builds trust with the public, but also reduces risk for prosecution. Because if you have a compromised officer as your primary witness, it compromises the case, compromises the process, leads to the kind of things that lead to protests and community uprisings. So, you know, overall, it's a win-win. It's increased accountability. And, you know, ultimately, the JSO will adjust to it. The union will adjust eventually. That's the way it usually goes.
And this list, it's known as the Brady Giglio list. It takes its name from a couple of Supreme Court decisions that have to do with what evidence prosecutors have to disclose to defense attorneys. Here in Jacksonville, Ryan Bank, Nelson's office has now dumped dozens of criminal cases because they relied on the testimony of police officers who have been arrested for various offenses.
Right. And there's two things to remember about this as well. And this is, great reporting by Ben Konark at the Florida Times Union. But there's two other things to remember. The first is that this could also be a double-edged sword for prosecutions because there could be, you know, in the story that was published, it was mentioned that there could be a minor infraction that an officer committed, and because of that, that gets kind of magnified in the media. And so there is a little bit of a worry by some prosecutors that having a list like this, especially in a state like Florida, where you have a really expansive public records law, could also put you kind of in the crosshairs of public opinion. And then aside from this, we also need to remember that although I'm not entirely sure what the union thinks of this, it is clear that the sheriff's office is squarely behind State Attorney Nelson when it comes to this.
Yes, Sheriff Mike Williams issued a statement in support. So no daylight at this time between the sheriff and the state attorney on some of these issues. And we want your calls. It's our Friday Media Roundtable, the top stories of the week, 549-2937. Nelson, of course, not surprising that she's getting props from former state attorney Harry Shorstein on these types of changes to the office.
Right. Indeed. One of the complaints people had about Angela Corey is that maybe she was too close to the police officers. As prosecutor, you're supposed to separate yourself and focus on the facts. And there were many who sat there and said, that's not what she did. She just, whatever the cop said, she bought and then went full throttle against whomever they accused of something. But fact of the matter is, in this town, there's been a history of that not being so. Even in members of the union have agreed with that. And now you have a sheriff who wants to basically, if we have bad apples, let's get rid of the bad apples and focus on the people who are good. I mean, good cops want to get rid of lousy cops the way good reporters want to get rid of lousy reporters.
See you later.
We do that. I mean, you're just making my job a lot harder, right?
We don't have the same process, though. But you know.
That's true.
Yes, our process, we won't talk about that. A.G. Gankarski.
The thin blue line.
Go ahead.
Okay. Now, going beyond this policy change involving police with their own arrest record, Melissa Nelson getting high marks generally in recent months for this more restorative justice, smart justice approach. It's a change for the city of Jacksonville.
Yeah.
And the 4th District.
Yeah, I mean, it is. And it's really consistent with what's happening right of center in terms of criminal justice reform. Mm-hmm. You know, it's consistent with what the Koch brothers and, you know, people like that want to happen. You know, sort of smart justice, things that aren't, you know, Jeff Sessions, like zero tolerance kind of legislation, but more like, well, how do we actually keep the peace? How do we actually maintain civil order in a time of diminishing resources, in a time of all the problems that we have locally and, you know, regionally and nationally? You know, it's a pragmatic approach, and really,
and one focused on the bottom line. There's this bipartisan recognition that the old way is wasting money.
Yeah, I mean, and that's really the thing. If you look at the old approach to criminal justice that maybe started in the 80s and, you know, went, you know, until Angela Corey's era here, you know, you saw a lot of wasted resources, and those resources have effects. I mean, you got issues like a jail that needs renovation. You've got issues like, you know, police and fire that have equipment that's 15 and 20 years old. And a lot of that, you know, honestly, is because of overstretch, because of overreach, because of inefficient policing. So it's something that, you know, over years can build trust, can actually, you know, make budgets work better, and, you know, can actually advance policing into a way that's more consistent with the entire community.
Right. And another thing we have to remember, too, that another story that came out of the TU this week was looking at how many more defense attorneys, former defense attorneys that Melissa Nelson was hiring to come work in her office. That is also a departure where more kind of seasoned prosecutors were the ones mostly staffing the previous state attorney's office. Now you're seeing a move to get people from the other side. And that should, in theory, at least provide some valuable perspective.
All right, let's go to your calls. It's our Friday roundtable as we look at the top stories of the week. 549-2937. Give us a call. Blair is in Mandarin. Hey, Blair, good morning.
Good morning. And bravo to Ms. Nelson. The more I see of her, the more I like her. A complete turnaround from Angela Corey. And I just can't say enough good things about it. I think that great things are going to happen in this city because of her. And I'll take my comments off the air. Thank you.
Blair, thanks for the call. Kevin.
She certainly has a... change the attitude of people have of the prosecutor's office in Jacksonville. It's because it seems like it was like that Angela Corey would just say, we're going to go after you, period. We're going to go full throttle. We're going to find the toughest thing we can prosecute you for and push that.
They've stopped having juveniles. Mm-hmm. They've stopped the practice of, you know, putting pressure on particularly a juvenile suspect to take a plea deal by threatening even more serious charges. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, that's a major deal. The fact that you've got, you know, juveniles that are actually working toward rehabilitation instead of being, you know, shoehorned into the adult correctional system, that is huge. And honestly, if you look at what's happened in the last few decades, especially in the African-American community. The results of mass incarceration, the results, you know, have led to, you know, families being separated and not being able to, you know, reunite. It's had real issues that have been created. So, you know, there are salutary effects go well beyond just law enforcement and prosecution.
All right.
And people convicted of felonies, which, despite what some people will just haunt you for the rest of your life. You're 17 years old, and you can convict of a felony. You're 50 years old, you still can't vote in the state of Florida.
Yeah.
And it's still on your record. And I mean, although there's been push to make changes in that, there are a lot of people who will not hire you for any job, despite the fact that whatever you did wrong happened 30 years ago.
And by the way, the creator of the Ban the Box movement to, you know, so that job applicants no longer have to check that they've been convicted of a felony, the creator of that whole concept came from right here in Jacksonville, Florida.
And that's Kevin Hyde?
Yeah. Well, he's one of the people, that is has been part of that. And that has spread around the country. Operation New Hope has been heavily involved in that.
That's a lot of very conservative people in town have actually pushed this. I mean, Robin Lum is one of those who have had, who pushed to get the city to pass this because he says, he goes, it just doesn't make any sense. I go, these people have paid their thing. They turned their lives around. Let them get a job. Otherwise, they're just going to go back to what they were doing.
Ryan.
Well, I mean, that seems to be the change in perception and in strategy with law, with prosecution. But we also have to remember, as much of a discretion that the state attorneys have in charging people with crimes, there's still a really, really, really tough opposition to these changes within law enforcement, from the police unions, from different law enforcement offices.
And will Melissa Nelson be challenged from the right when re-election time comes around from someone more palatable to the union?
No way, and I'll tell you why. Because, you know, whoever comes out against her is going to get the worst oppo dump since Angela Corey got her oppo dumps in 2016. It was every day there was a bombshell about Angela Corey. If anybody broaches that kind of challenge to Melissa Nelson, it's going to be the end of whatever political career they might have had.
And you think that's because players behind the scenes will line up behind Nelson?
It's Brian Hughes and Tim Baker.
The consultants that ran her campaign.
Yes.
Okay, 549-2937. Rachel is in Mandarin. Hi, Rachel.
Hey. I think looking at the whole picture is important, and I just wanted to remind everybody that there are victims. I think victims are so often forgotten. And I'm not saying the Nelson decision here is wrong. Obviously, we need some help. Our criminal justice system needs some help from the law enforcement side to the court system. But there are people who get to sit by and watch, you know, the offender, the charges dropped, and no accountability there. And that's painful.
Yeah, thanks, Rachel, for that point as well.
Well, but oftentimes in post-conviction, and this is the argument for the Brady List, was that oftentimes in post-conviction, you'll have something overturned because it'll come out that the officer was compromised in some fashion.
And that
fashion,
does not help the victim.
And that doesn't help the victim either. So it's a delicate balance, and there's really at this point, you know, it's a double-edged sword. There's really no other way to describe it.
Right, and there's this thing called double jeopardy. If you go to prosecute somebody and you don't have all your ducks in a row and they're found not guilty, that's it. Doesn't matter. You could come in tomorrow with all the evidence you need. You can't prosecute them again.
All right, and if you're just tuning in, it's our Friday roundtable looking at the top stories of the week. Also making headlines this week, some movement in people eyeing local congressional seats, which will be up in 2018. Former Ambassador to the United Nations Nancy Soderbergh has filed to challenge Congressman Ron DeSantis for his District 6 seat that encompasses Volusia and Flagler counties in the Maine. Now, Soderbergh is a Democrat. She's director of the Public Service Leadership Program at UNF. She was an ambassador during the Clinton administration to the UN and was also a high-ranking official with the U.S. National Security Council. She ran unsuccessfully for a Florida State Senate seat in 2012 against Aaron Bean, but is now trying to capitalize on what national Democratic operatives think will be a Democratic wave in 2018. UNF Professor Monica DePaul, meanwhile, will challenge Congressman John Rutherford for his District 4 seat here in Jacksonville. If elected, DePaul would be the first openly transgender person to serve in Congress. Here's our question now to callers. Do you think candidates around the country will capitalize on a Democratic wave of outrage against the Trump administration? We want your calls, 549-2937. Let's begin with the Soderberg play for CD6. And of course, AG Gankarski, as you reported the other day in Florida Politics, Nancy Soderberg is betting that DeSantis is going to seek either the Florida gubernatorial race, the governor's mansion, or run for Florida Attorney General. As others have speculated, if DeSantis leaves his seat in Congress to go for another office, then Soderberg can capitalize on a whole scrum of Republican candidates trying to get that party's nomination. And she's going to have Bill Nelson joined at the hip to her. She's going to raise a lot of money. Can she capitalize on these factors in this race?
Yeah, that's the play. I mean, if you get a weak candidate in CD6 on the Republican side, if you get Trump continuing to do what Trump's been doing for the last 6 months, issues like that, she may be able to make a play. The problem with that district is it's really divided up into three parts. St. John's has its culture, Volusia has its culture, Flagler has its culture. You got to have ground troops in all those areas. You've got to be able to work TV in both the Jacksonville market, the Orlando market, and even the Daytona market. So you basically have two major media markets and one semi-major one. You've also got, in Soderberg, a professorial kind of demeanor. She's not your handshaking Gwen Graham, I'm going to hug you politician. I mean, she's very much, policy wonk. Will that translate down there in that region? I mean, that remains to be seen. But if she gets a bad candidate, if she gets some good tailwinds, a bad candidate opposing her, some good tailwinds, and the money that we're expecting, and some good people who actually know the region to run the campaign, not just some recycled Clinton people, but people who actually know the area and know how to win down there, she may have a shot.
Okay, and Ryan Bank.
that last part is the most important part.
Yeah, and as AG has reported in politics, the mother's milk is money. Soderberg is going to have a lot of money behind her, and probably much less so for this other candidate taking on John Rutherford. Monica DePaul, who's also a UNF professor.
Yeah, and I've got some thoughts on that as well, and the way that that's been reported in different outlets. But
tell me more.
the first thing in reference to Soderberg, and actually just generally speaking, Florida Democrats and national Democrats, we've already seen that just pouring money into a race is not enough.
And you're talking about that.
We're talking about Ossoff
that
in
race
Georgia
in Atlanta. This guy John Ossoff lost.
Right. Yeah. And look, the way districts are drawn. I mean, if you've got that Republican advantage, it doesn't really matter.
You know what though? I checked this district, CD6. Has been redrawn after the lawsuit that was filed. It's still right leaning, but less so.
Right, but
I think is why she's decided to jump in.
Right. Right, and it's a marginal change. Like AG said, if she surrounds herself with a smart team of local people, she may have a chance. But if people see, to use an often overused phrase, but I think it's very apt here. If people see it as kind of like a mission of a carpetbagger to come in with a bunch of outside national people who are trying to take a national top level down to local level approach mm-hmm. to winning this election, I think you'd be hard pressed to find any political strategist that would say that she'd have a good chance of winning.
Okay.
And she needs to focus on Kevin. Things like local issues like jobs. I mean, she's well known for knowing things about Russia and national stuff, but that's not going to get you elected to Congress because people usually focus on the local stuff,
right.
The jobs and things like that. What is she going to do
their
to bring
back
to this?
Let's talk about the fact, too, that this is a candidate who was probably going to talk a lot about health care. To your point, Kevin, mm-hmm. This is a district where in Volusia County alone, some 70,000 people would be losing their insurance if the current health care package that the Senate is looking at is enacted into law. I think you can expect a lot of discussion about health care, and I think you can expect to see her on the stump with Senator Bill Nelson, who, by the way, is in a reelection fight of his own. Can Nelson help Nancy Soderbergh in this district?
Nelson has to help himself first.
AG.
I mean, he's yeah. going to be going. Mm-hmm. We've been talking about the speculation for I don't know how long now, but he's going to be going up against
current
governor.
Rick Scott's got the best political operation in the state. Bill Nelson is going to have a hard time with that one unless he steps his game up. But you know, with Soderbergh, there's only this is the consensus, but there's only so much help she can really get from Bill Nelson. I mean, in the end, she's got to have a gear she did demonstrate in 2012 against Aaron Bean. She's got to be able to project empathy, project that, you know, she's one of the people in that area, because whoever she runs against is going to be like a state legislature mm-hmm. or somebody who actually lives down there, who's got ties, and they're going to say, why is Jacksonville trying to take our seat? It's very easy to do that mailer, and that mailer would be devastating.
All right, let's go to your calls. 549
The clean connection is not going to help her either.
549-2937. Donald in St. Augustine. Go ahead, Donald.
The people who were just talking had some very interesting points, and I have recently arrived in St. Augustine, so I don't know a lot about local politics. But I find it fascinating that they speak of the Democrat wave election of 2018. I wonder if that's anything similar to the Democrat wave election of 2016 when they were supposed to take everything.
Yeah.
I am also a former resident of the district in Georgia, where Ossoff, what we called him, the carpetbagger, lost. So, I think everybody's just trying to go with the same old story, you know, that we're going to take a false premise and continue talking about it until it turns into the truth. So I just find it fascinating.
Yeah.
And thank you very much.
Thanks, Donald. Right. And to Donald's point, obviously the Democratic Party is hoping for a wave. Doesn't mean that one is necessarily mm-hmm. going to come about.
Well, I mean, we see a president who's below 40% in the most polls. The White House is rudderless. It's got scandals at the very top.
And will that translate down to these races?
You know, you got to look at it over, you've got a year for this stuff to develop. I mean, it's going to get serious next summer.
Yeah.
So the narrative's going to be drip, 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 like everybody on TV keeps saying. But it's true. I mean, every day there's a new bombshell about this White House. Every day it gets harder for people in Congress to yoke themselves to the White House. You know, as rough as George W. Bush's presidency was, you didn't see Republicans running away from Bush in the way that you're already seeing from Trump. And we're only 6 months in. If you fast forward a year, what's it going to look like? It's not going to look better.
Catherine on the Northwest side. Hi, Catherine.
Hi, good morning. I am currently registered as no party because the independent party, which I was a part of, has been eliminated or it's not recognized by the state, given they haven't met some reporting requirements. But my comments on whether the Democrats will run a wave of having electeds in the office in 2018. I think it depends on the candidates. It doesn't matter whether who they are. I'm sorry. But I think that the candidate that the Democrats run will have to have some experience. It can't be a candidate with no experience. And then whoever is running, we need to take a look as voters as to who would be behind these candidates, the money that supports them, and the agendas that these people will be pushing. If you're familiar with Jane Meyer's book, Dark Money, we need to get the people such as promoting these people out of office and not elect those who are trying to get in office promoting these people's agenda. Those are my comments.
Sure.
Thank you.
Thanks, Catherine.
We have to also remember that the map does not really look that great at all mm-hmm. for Democrats in 2018. So to expect a wave is lofty at best.
And you're talking the national map, the map in Florida, this
national
particular map.
The national map. I mean, well, first of all, these districts, you mentioned that the district that Soderbergh will be running in is slightly less difficult for her. It does lean right. But then you're also talking about Congressman John Rutherford's district, which is incredibly safe for Republicans. And, you know, I just don't see how with the seats that are up for elections this 2018, I don't see how Democrats can pull off a wave. They might be able to stem the tide of further defeat, but it'll be very difficult to argue that there'll be a wave.
Mel in St. Augustine. Go ahead, Mel.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good morning.
Basically, I live in Nancy's in District 6, U.S. House District 6. And I'd like to say that Nancy Soderbergh has done her homework. She has started visiting with the Democratic Party and different groups throughout the district. She's been to St. Augustine. I've seen her in Jacksonville at an event. I've actually seen her on television several times recently, being able to have make responsible comments about what's happening at the national level. Having been in Ron DeSantis' district since he was first elected, he's done nothing for us. He's supposed to be representing us, but one of the things that I've found with Nancy is she is doing her homework. She is trying to find out what the issues are. And I found her, when she joined a group of us for lunch one day, very personable. And I don't think she's going to have any problem being able to reach out on an individual level.
Okay, thanks, Mel. Jean in Jacksonville. Hey, Jean, you're on the air. All right, we lost Jean. Oh, well. Well, a lot of comments about that. We'll continue to follow those races. In business news, meanwhile, just as the new Amazon Fulfillment Center on Jacksonville's north side took thousands of applications this week for open jobs, the future of the troubled Regency Square Mall in Arlington got cloudier. The International Decor Outlet and Asian Town in Regency Square say they've been forced to scale back plans to rejuvenate the whole mall. The company filed a lawsuit saying problems with the mall, specifically a leaking roof and faulty air conditioning, are preventing it from adding any more tenants. Now, the move follows the closure of an automobile museum in the Regency Mall earlier this year. Owners there also blamed the leaking roof. So as traditional malls struggle and close, e-tailing in the form of Amazon in particular is going gangbusters. AG, we saw photos of this long line of job applicants this week outside the Amazon Fulfillment Center that's coming to Jacksonville. They had some job fairs and they're planning more. So we're looking at a facility on Pecan Park Road in North Jacksonville, another one at the Cecil Commerce Center.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I'll touch on Regency briefly. A long, slow, sad, inexorable decline.
Yeah.
We've talked about it for years. We'll talk about it for years to come. The Amazon story is a great one, though, because despite the death of traditional retail, when you saw those people in lines at the Legend Center, those people were going to get jobs. Those people were in a neighborhood, in an area of town that, you know, has job deficits, that doesn't have innate employment opportunities. So, you know, to see those people get jobs, I mean, that's a neighborhood stabilization measure right there. So, you know, the turnout did not surprise me. It's got to encourage Amazon. It's got to encourage the city. And, you know, it makes the case for, you know, more economic development. If you get big companies to come here, they can offer big job packages. And, you know, these aren't all great jobs. I mean, a lot of these are $10 an hour jobs that'll ring your back. But, you know,
and Amazon's taken a lot of flack for its working conditions, its, you know, its labor practices. I mean, this is a mixed bag. That said, what are all of your thoughts about the fact that traditional retail is just getting killed, not just at malls?
It depends on what you mean by traditional retail. So,
brick and mortar retail.
Right. Well, if that's the definition, then I think the death of that type of retail has been greatly exaggerated. Because if you cater to the right audiences, being my generation, millennials, if you cater to the right audiences, people will come. Now, look at one thing. Look at the town center. Look at outlet malls that are cropping up everywhere in this state and across the country. You have to give people an experience. You have to give them good prices, and you have to give them brand names at at knockoff prices, essentially.
And that's what I'm getting at, is like the traditional stores that aren't figuring that out, they're not making it.
Right. If as a mall, and I think, you know, to Regency's credit, as the lawsuits are flying back and forth between the new leasers and the owners of the property and all of that. But that being said, what they were trying to do with Asian Town, what they were trying to do with the international marketplace, was give people an experience, give them a reason to come to this mall instead of just because you need to go.
And it's so sad to see that it's falling apart.
Right. Well, I mean, you have to maintain the building that you have. Right. If you don't, your tenants are not going to want to rent that space.
I mean, look at the Avenues isn't having these problems. Yeah. I mean, it's owned by the same people, but it may be maybe location. It's a little farther away from the town center, which is just, I think, really have sucked a lot out of the Regency. But people still go to the Avenues all the time. They have different stores.
Alfred Angelo also closing in Regency. The serene and majestic Michelle Corum just reminded me to say. Just throwing that out there.
Morning until I join you.
Okay. Also making headlines this week, Jacksonville's first medical marijuana dispensary opened its doors Wednesday to patients. At the Trulieve dispensary, you can get medical marijuana in capsules, oils, vaporizers, even a topical cream, but not in smokable form.
Yeah, I was actually at that opening. And, the smokable lawsuit, that's a John Morgan thing. That's a subject for another time. But, you know, here's the thing about this dispensary. It was really boring.
Really?
All the people worried about bud tenders and worried about, oh, is this going to be like Denver or something? No, it's basically like an Apple store. You go in, you've got a display case, you see like vape pens, you see bottles of capsules.
That's kind of a letdown in some sense, isn't it?
But it's not, because what it's doing is it's actually normalizing, you know, the product itself. It's divorcing the product from, you know, the subculture of Snoop Dogg and the fish. And,
right. It's legitimizing THC.
Yes. I mean, and that's really a discussion that needs to happen. Because if you look at what's happening, you know, in Jacksonville, Florida, and the South, you know, we've had a Jim Crow approach, you know, to marijuana for decades. You go out west where these weren't the Jim Crow states, and magically they're able to actually run a city integrating it in as a product. You go to Nevada or something, Nevada's got shortages right now because they're working out a distribution model.
And how much in school funding has Colorado?
Right.
They're seeing a lot of revenue, and that's going to increase the pressure for recreational marijuana to eventually be. They're going to point to Colorado and say, look at all the revenue.
I mean, our legislators here in Florida, at least the ones that have been, you know, like Fleming Island Republican Senator Rob Bradley, have been very, very, very supportive of everything up until recreational. When I spoke to him last, you know, shortly after the compromise that was made at the end of this special session, he said, listen, the federal government's got to take this off the Schedule 1. The federal government needs to take this off.
That's
we need to do more
point,
research.
Ryan, because this is still, let me point out, this is still illegal at the federal level. So, Kevin, when you go to Trulieve, you have to pay cash for this product.
Right.
And they have an ATM there in case you don't have any cash.
That's right. And it's set up. I remember I stopped at one in Los Angeles when I was at Loyola. Just down the street, and it looks more like it's not a pot shop. It's basically a little store. It's set up as like a little medical place.
Like a drugstore.
It's like a drugstore. And, you know, they're behind the door, and they says, you got to show us your, get your doctor stuff, and here you can have this. Here's a couple of brownies or something you can have. But it's not set up as like some of the pipe shops we have in town.
Sure.
It's set up like your basic medical center.
The first one in town. And finally, it's our look at the strange, bizarre, and just plain ridiculous from the week. Luckily, there is never a shortage of material for this panel. Here it is for you right now. Only in Florida. Speaking of drugs, only in Florida do drug dealers use a Cookie Monster doll to hide their blow. Yes.
See, it's for cocaine.
Police down in the Keys made the discovery during a traffic stop. The Monroe County Sheriff's Office sharing a photo of the doll on social media. Inside was two packages of cocaine that police found hidden inside. They had stopped the driver for driving with dark tinted windows and obscuring his license plate.
I don't know if there's ever comment.
I don't know if there's a more appropriate character to use, unless you were going to go the Jim Henson route and maybe Beaker becomes.
What about Animal? I liked him. Remember that was the moment.
Well, Animal clearly had his issues.
Only in Florida do would-be robbers try a little cross-dressing to carry out their crime in disguise. Three men dressed as women eluded Florida deputies for several days after violently robbing a string of Home Depots. In Winter Haven, this gang roughed up a 73-year-old clerk while stealing hundreds of dollars worth of gift cards. Then they went over to Lakeland, did the same thing there. They put the 69-year-old clerk there in a chokehold, all while dressed in drag.
Well, they clearly picked old targets.
Dressed to kill.
Home Depot.
There you go. Thank you.
Yeah. Finally, only in Florida. Only in Florida is a clergyman arrested for road rage. Yes, 35-year-old William Adams of Fletcher, North Carolina, is facing charges. Now, Adams is an Episcopal priest, but his faith did not help him keep his calm this week after he allegedly pointed a handgun at another vehicle as they were driving along the Florida Turnpike. Adams facing two counts of aggravated assault with a deadly weapon.
Two Lord's Prayers, 15 Hail Marys.
Hallelujah.
You know.
AG, I'm disappointed.
I
you got nothing on that?
No.
I'm shocked.
I used it all up on Cookie Monster.
It's the turnpike. People are like,
Thank you, AG Gankarski, Ryan Bank, and Kevin Mershart. The guys have a great weekend.
Thank you. And may God have mercy on your soul.
And we'll be right back.
Sometimes jobs are more than just jobs. They can bring whole towns and different generations together.
I've had two grandfathers that worked for the mills. My uncle worked for the mills. I and two of my brothers worked for the mills.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. What happens, though, when that mill closes? We'll tell you the story next time on Marketplace.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Who is your American graduate champion? WJCT is looking to recognize and honor a wide range of community leaders and everyday heroes who regularly dedicate their time, talent, and resources to prepare students for success and graduation. American graduate champions are role models in their communities whose stories have the potential to inspire others to take action. The nomination deadline is July 17th. Click the button on WJCT.org to nominate your American graduate champion today.
Make an appointment with Public Radio's favorite family doc on the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health. It'll be a jam-packed hour on healthy living, including this tasty recipe for
salmon and black bean tostadas.
We always have a great time, so will you on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRX.
Sundays at 5 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, it's a new and faith-based project designed to improve community health here on the First Coast by removing barriers to care, like access to health services and behavioral health support. The Humana Foundation, the philanthropic arm of Humana, is providing more than $400,000 to local nonprofits in town to improve the health and well-being of residents. Here with more, we welcome Dr. Carolyn Tucker. She's the UF and Florida Blue Endowed Chair in Health Disparities Research. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to see you. Also with us, Laura Nolan, Health Solutions Executive with Humana. Good to see you.
Good to see you, Melissa.
Thanks, ladies, for being here. A big grant from Humana Foundation. Dr. Tucker, let's begin with you. This is a big step forward for the community in terms of improving health, and you're going to also leverage the power of the local faith-based community.
Yes.
How is this going to work?
Well, we are going to be working with six black churches in Zone 1 in Jacksonville, and this will be the first type of initiative of its kind. We will have centers where people can come in and get their blood pressure checked, get their weight checked, and they also can get interventions to address obesity and hypertension. And we, what's really excited about this is that we will have partners working with us, and these will be businesses, healthcare sites and food stores, et cetera, who will actually provide support for the interventions that we will be engaged in there.
Very nice. Mm-hmm. So Health Smart centers at six largely African-American churches, mm-hmm. Bethel Baptist, Greater Grant Memorial AME, mm-hmm. St. Stephen AME, St. Paul AME, Mount Olive Primitive Baptist, and Shiloh Metropolitan Baptist Church. Mm-hmm. Laura Nolan, bringing the faith community on board is a key part, and but there are some other moving parts to this as well. Why? Tell us a little bit more about Humana's goal with this, because this is part of your Bold Goal initiative to really improve the health of this area overall.
Absolutely, Melissa. As you know, Jacksonville is a key focus for the Humana Foundation, and that's why we certainly have selected to offer a grant to this program. Our focus is to improve the health of Jacksonville 20% by the year 2020. And when we evaluated the Health Smart Church Center program, we really realized that this is a project that can be that tipping point for Jacksonville, specifically in Health Zone 1, mm-hmm. in areas where we need to change the health behaviors to improve the health and well-being.
Dr. Tucker, it's so important in Health Zone 1, for the whole country, really, yes. Not just Health Zone 1, but in particular, you're looking at high rates of obesity, diabetes, and hypertension, correct?
Yes.
Those are critical health problems.
Yes.
So let's talk a little bit about, on the ground, how these church centers are going to work with their flocks to get folks healthier, bring down the blood pressure, mm-hmm. bring down the diabetes rates, all of that.
So basically, we will be empowering individuals at the churches to take charge of their health under whatever conditions that exist. So we have this program that I developed. It's called Health Smart. It's evidence-based. We've tried it in other churches before now. But people who participate in the churches, in the program, there will be 30 individuals at each one of the churches. They will go through our 8-week program, and then we will be assessing their weight, their blood pressure, their number of well days, and we also will be assessing their stress and depression levels. Mm-hmm. So we will be teaching them skills for managing stress and depression. We'll be teaching them, giving them knowledge and skills for engaging in health-promoting behaviors that we call health-smart behaviors. And we know that this works, okay? That's phase one. And then our second phase, which is the intervention program, or what we call the center, which it will be the first in the state of Florida and also the first in the nation. And again, this is where people can get information about preparing for healthcare visits. They'll get information about health-smart behaviors. And let me just say, at that point, we will be moving beyond just the churches, but also the communities in which those churches are located. Because we also know that to promote health, it really does take a village. So we will have then all of those community organizations working with us to sustain the health behaviors. And one of the things I really want to add is that we know that various programs can help people lose weight for a very short period of time. The issue is now, even at the National Institutes of Health and everywhere, they are looking for programs that will sustain those health-promoting behaviors and sustain the weight loss. So that's what's novel about our centers, is then we will be able to have providers, health, physical, fitness persons, everybody actually coming to the churches. And I call this deinstitutionalizing medicine. So rather than them going to healthcare sites where they might feel uncomfortable or not be satisfied with the care, we are having the providers, everybody actually coming to the churches.
Laura, pretty exciting stuff.
Absolutely. You know, with the Bold Goal, we have a key focus on mental health and behavioral health, as well as diabetes. And as you've just heard Dr. Tucker, this is really going to help tackle both of those issues and help to support the well-being.
Okay. And how can people access all of this new stuff? Because this is free to the community, right?
Yes, it is free. And I think probably the easiest thing is to call me, Dr. Carolyn Tucker, at the University of Florida. I'm easy to find, and we can provide a lot of information, as well as our partners at Humana.
Yeah, BoldGoldJacksonville.
Yes.
BoldGoldJacksonville.com, or if you're a parishioner at any of the churches we mentioned, they have information there, too. Dr. Carolyn Tucker, thanks so much for joining us. Laura Nolan of Humana, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Melissa.
We'll be right back.
Next time on 1A, it's the global edition of the Friday News Roundup, a week that marked a major moment for Iraq.
The chances of people being alive here are very, very slim. There is still a lot of misery in Mosul.
Also, Brazil sends its former president to prison, and President Trump looks for an alternative agreement in Paris. The Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A. Weekdays at 11 on 89.9 WJCT. Hey there, I'm Joshua Johnson, the host of 1A, and I am coming to WJCT Studios for a free listening party for younger public radio listeners. They'll be featuring a Skype Q&A with me, thought-provoking conversation, and refreshments, of course. The event is on Tuesday, July 25th from 6 to 8 p.m. Registration is free, but you do have to sign up. You'll find more online at wjct.org/events.
Sponsored in part by Firehouse Subs.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, the River City Chorus Concert Series is coming up next week. It's called Sing a New Song, a program of contemporary choral music to energize the human spirit. And it's a reminder that true love and hope and a new beginning is possible for everyone. Now, each night at these concerts, they will do a collection for the local nonprofit Rethreaded. Here with more, Wayne Bailey of River City Chorus. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
Good to have you. And Kristen Keene, founder and president of Rethreaded.
Hello.
Good to see you both. More about Rethreaded in a moment. But first, Wayne Bailey, tell us a little bit about this concert series, because you're going to be hopping around to churches, it looks like, all across the community for the next
week.
Yes,
we are. This is our eighth season. Goodness, how fast time flies. We're going to be at Riverside Park United Methodist Church on Tuesday at 7:30, Southside Baptist Church on Friday the 21st at 7:30, Saturday at Island View Baptist Church at 8 p.m., and Sunday 3 p.m. at Arlington Baptist Church. And some wonderful churches that are willing to support us. And this great organization, I loved them from the beginning when it said Rethreaded, Sewing a New Story.
That's right. So this will raise funds for Rethreaded. They'll take up the collection plate, just like you do.
When the concert's over, when people are leaving.
Mm-hmm. People can donate to Rethreaded. Kristen Keene, you've appeared on this program many times, but for people that don't know about Rethreaded, let's talk about your mission.
So Rethreaded is giving survivors of human trafficking a new chance at life through employment. So we give long-term employment and career development to survivors, and they work at Rethreaded, and they have a chance to be empowered and change the world.
And you make some amazing products, by the way.
And we make some amazing products. Of course, I'm wearing today our gray scarf, which is our key product that everyone knows around the city. So it's really exciting to have that now.
Yeah, I have one too. It's a beautiful scarf, and it was upcycled from old t-shirts, basically. But it looks nothing like that. It's a beautiful product, and like so many of your products, the tagline is perfect. You're sewing a new story for women and for these textiles too, as they take on new life. And so, Wayne, River City Chorus is such a great community institution.
Thank you.
Men and women participate.
Correct, yes.
And so what kinds of music are you going to be performing?
I'm very excited about our program this year, and I think that most, if not all, of the music will be brand new to all the listeners, and the texts are what really impress me. The music's beautiful, but the texts are texts that we can all use in our daily lives, and especially they pertain to these wonderful folks who work through Rethreaded. I think this year, this now in our time, that we need reinforcement to hope. In all of our lives, we're bombarded with a lot of negativity, and I promise you this will not be a concert that has anything to do with negativity. It will be very positive, and I'm so proud of the adults who joined us during the summer. We have about 80 folks this year who give up 8 weeks of their life to work on this music, and no one's paid. We all do it because of the love of it and because of our love for this city and of organizations we've sponsored.
Well, have fun. There's a whole series, so you can pick your concert, but this kicks off next Tuesday night at 7:30 p.m. at Riverside Park United Methodist Church. It's Sing a New Song Concert Series benefiting Rethreaded. Wayne, Kristen, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Melissa.
We're going to close with some music from the River City Chorus. That's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Mershart. Michelle Corum runs the board. The show theme composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. If you missed anything this morning, hear our rebroadcast tonight at 8. 1A's up next. I'm Melissa Ross, and this has been First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be back Monday at 9 a.m. Enjoy the music and have a great weekend.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.
Florida TPO, proud sponsor of WJCT's First Coast Connect, bringing to the community innovation in transportation planning, commuter services, clean fuels, and intelligent transportation systems. More at northfloridatpo.com.